You're listening to the Irish Times Roisin Meets podcast.
Welcome back to Roisin Meets. My guest today is the US defence lawyer Dean Strang, who many of you will recognise for his role on the Netflix show Making a Murderer. Dean provided legal representation for Stephen Avery, twice convicted of murder in Wisconsin, who came to public attention in the series documenting the overturning of his first conviction and the procedural details of his second. The series drew global audiences and shone a light on the injustices of the US legal system, as well as turning Dean into a bit of an unlikely sex symbol.
You should laugh out loud, which is exactly what my wife has done.
Dean has been in Ireland for the past few weeks for a guest lecture series, which is soon coming to an end, at the Law Department of the University of Limerick. I took the opportunity to invite him in for a chat about his work on the Avery case, how he came to be a defence lawyer in the first place, and just what is wrong with the US justice system. He isn't on Stephen Avery's legal team anymore, but Dean is up to date with how it's going. So I began by asking him to fill us in on that.
Well, there's two men, as anybody who's seen the movie knows. Stephen Avery was my client. At the moment, his current legal team, led by Kathleen Zellner, is on appeal in the Wisconsin state courts, trying to convince those courts that she has adduced sufficient new evidence to warrant a new trial. And Brendan Dassey, Stephen's nephew, has been on a very different track. He was able to go to federal court, which provides limited review of state convictions under U.S. law. He had won in the federal trial court, won on appeal, but then when the state of Wisconsin pursued further review by the full Court of Appeals in Chicago, Brendan lost by a single vote. So at the moment, he remains in prison, and just last week, his extraordinarily good legal team petitioned the United States Supreme Court to hear the case. The Supreme Court need not hear his case or any other, so it remains to be seen whether that court will, and we'll probably know that in June.
And what's your own feelings about him and his situation? I mean, he's mentally impaired, is that correct?
Learning disabilities, yeah. At a minimum, yes. I have always found Brendan's case very very difficult and horrifying. Other than an unsound confession we fed to him by the police, there's no evidence to support the proposition that he did anything wrong. So it's tragic would be the nicest way I could put it, that he remains in prison now almost 11 years.
Yeah, I mean, he's 28 later. Now, and he was 16, I think, when...
That's exactly right.
Yeah, it is tragic is the only word, and there's worse words, but we won't use them.
That's
on
right.
The podcast. Your life, I presume, since Making the Murderer completely changed, or did it as much? I'd just be interested in what effect it had on you as a lawyer, as a person in the world as well, on your family, friends, that kind of thing.
The filming of the movie had little or no effect, but its release probably 8 years after most of the filming was done, from my perspective, it had a big impact on my life, big and unexpected. So whatever normal was on December 18, 2015, the day Making a Murderer came out, normal has shifted a couple of feet now, a little more than 2 years later for me. It's really had a substantial impact on day-to-day life.
So tell me how.
Well, the sheer number of opportunities to speak, to participate in meetings and conferences and discussions has exploded for me since then. And initially, especially in the first 6 months or so, I had up to 150 emails a day from strangers coming in that I wanted to acknowledge and to which I wanted to respond, because you have to understand that just remarkably, over 99% of the unsolicited contact I've had from strangers has been thoughtful, kind, polite, I can count on my two hands and probably have a finger or two left over the number of unpleasant contacts people have initiated with me. So just managing correspondence with new people, I've had the chance to travel, to listen and to speak. You know, it's unthinkable that I would be spending 2 months at the University of Limerick on a visiting fellowship were it not for Making a Murderer. So, you know, while I'd enjoyed some success in my career before then, this is not career success. This is something altogether different.
And just on the fact that, you know, that's you, the two of you, Booting and yourself, who were involved with Avery's case, got so much attention. But for you, I presume, because we've seen how passionate you are, how emotional, you know, getting choked up at various points in the filming, it's obviously something deeply passionate for you. And the idea that it shone a light on the American legal system and how unfair it is to the most vulnerable and the poorest in society, is that what kind of motivates you still, and is that where you were glad it was made?
Yes and yes. You know, if you work in the criminal justice system and you have your eyes open, you are aware that you're surrounded by varied forms of poverty every day. Not just financial poverty, but poverty of education, poverty of language skills, poverty of mental health, poverty of opportunity, emotional resources, all kinds of vectors of poverty. And you can talk about that till you're blue in the face, but it's hard to be heard outside the criminal justice system. I mean, there's very little sympathy, really, when you get right down to it. Certainly for people charged with a crime, and remarkably little sympathy for people who are victims of crime, other than the lip service we pay to victims and you know, to wanting to reduce crime rates. But we don't do very much, actually, for victims, let alone for the accused. And so Making a Murderer, because of the light it's shown on one moment, one, you know, two men's cases in a obscure corner of the United States, I think has allowed a much broader conversation about the dangers and the outright failings of the criminal justice system. And of course, that's not just Wisconsin's. It's not just the United States legal system. I mean, trying to administer justice is a project that shares the same obstacles almost anywhere you go. Yes, the local details are different here or there, but many of the same issues, that is, how do we confront and understand the poverty that pervades the criminal justice systems almost anywhere in the world, are quite common. So it's been a real gift to have an opportunity to engage with audiences around the world and to have a peek at the legal systems in different countries around the world.
We'll talk about some of those failings, particularly in the US system, later on, but I wanted to get to know you a little bit more and about what kind of shaped you in terms of your journey towards being a defense lawyer. So where did you grow up?
I was born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and lived there until I went off to college.
Spent what kind of family did you have? What did your parents do?
My dad was an industrial engineer or a manufacturing engineer. He had gone to college and indeed had gotten a master's degree. My mother was a school teacher. She also had a college degree. Both sides of my family, probably my mother's especially, but in a different way, my father's, valued education a great deal. There was no question from an early age that my sister and I, she's just a year younger, that my sister and I would go to college, that we would continue our education. You know, where and how we did that, my parents, I think, gave us a great deal of encouragement to look to a larger world, not to confine our sights just to our hometown or even our home state.
And as a young person in high school, was law something that always intrigued you? Were you kind of person who was very, into justice and that kind of thing in your school?
No,
or no?
No, not really.
What were you into?
I single-mindedly wanted to be a political cartoonist.
Okay, that's and quite specific.
Single-mindedly wanted to do that from about age 8. My dad was never enamored of that plan.
Right.
He was the one who thought I ought to be a lawyer because he thought I had a facility with language, with spoken and written word, in a way that he didn't. And I think he envied and encouraged me to do that. He had a sister who was and still is a lawyer, and she was sort of the brightest person in the family. So I think he looked up to that older sister. And saw law as a good path. I wasn't much interested. I really did want to be a cartoonist.
And what about who did you admire in terms of the cartoonist world? Who were you following at that time? And Kate is very young to kind of get into political cartoons.
Oh, no. I was a big fan of Bill Malden, longtime Chicago cartoonist after working for Stars and Stripes, the military paper, for years. Pat Oliphant. My local hometown guy was Bill Sanders, and another one named Tom Curtis.
And did you have aptitude for this, Dean?
I did. I did have an aptitude for it, and probably could have pursued it. And I continued it through college and into law school. But my third year in college,
Did you go to college?
Dartmouth College in New Hampshire. And I made what's still one of the most mature decisions I've ever made at age 20, surprisingly, which was that as much as I loved cartooning, it probably wouldn't be a good job, a good vocation for me for 40 or 50 years. Now, I, of course, didn't foresee that newspapers would be on the verge of collapse because of the internet. I didn't foresee the internet. But I did foresee that to move up in cartooning, one would have to be willing to go anywhere in the country to papers of increasingly large circulation. And I didn't see myself wanting that sort of a rootless life. Cartooning is also very solitary. You participate in the editorial board meeting in the morning, but then you close the office door and hope that inspiration strikes. So it's a very solitary pursuit under daily deadline pressure. And all of those things, I thought, as much as I love this, I'm not sure I would continue to love it, living and trying to make a living doing it.
But it sounds like you went to study law because your dad wanted you to, which I suppose a lot of people do, and there's people who, you know, not saying he was living through you, but he certainly saw that you had a capacity for this, and his sister was someone that, you know, maybe you got your legal sort of brains from her. But you were essentially doing it not following your passion at that stage, necessarily.
That's exactly right. Once I decided not to be a cartoonist, I didn't have a plan B, as we say. And my father's nudging about law school was one thing I had to fall back on. And this was also when I graduated from college in June of 1982. It was a point at which law school admissions seemed almost endless. There seemed an unending market for law students and young lawyers. So I hit the market, if you will, at a particularly lucky time. But I have to say it was sheer fortuity that I really liked law school, that I very quickly, more than liked it, I loved it. That was sheer fortuity.
So you didn't anticipate that necessarily, and you were kind of doing it because, okay, at least I can tick this off and dad will be okay.
And I have to do something.
Yeah.
And, right.
That's interesting, isn't it, that he obviously knew more than you did about yourself in a way. Like sometimes parents do.
Sometimes parents
and
do.
Sometimes probably. They really don't.
Well, he didn't get everything right, but he and my mother got a lot right in assessing both me and my sister.
So in law college, is it like, does it become like, I'm definitely going to be a defense attorney? Do you kind of decide that while you're there, or is that something that comes later?
Some do. Some go into law school with a very clear idea of what they want to do with a law degree. I, again, was not one of those people because law school was an afterthought, and I didn't have a clear idea of what I wanted to do. Oddly enough, I was pretty sure what I didn't want to do. I didn't want to ever be in a courtroom. I didn't want to be a trial lawyer, I thought I wouldn't like the contentiousness of it, the adversary nature of it. I thought I'd probably be happier doing pension work or something like that.
Were you shy?
Yes, and am. By nature.
By nature, would that not be a trait associated with many lawyers? Is that fair to say?
Well, lawyers, sure, but trial lawyers aren't known for being shy.
No.
Or retiring.
No.
And I've never had a typical trial lawyer personality. I think in many ways, my weaknesses as a trial lawyer are because my personality is not a great fit with some of it. But then that also probably has allowed me to stand apart from others for the same reasons. Mm.
When you talk about the fact that you might have been doing pensions, which would be a whole other story of your life then, when did you get to a point where you actually thought, okay, even though it doesn't appeal to me and it sounds like it was something that would have terrified you, the confrontation, the adversarial nature of the trial. What happened to sort of change your mind on that?
I don't know. Again, serendipity. I think the only thing I can put my finger on is that from the time I've been small, I have instinctively been on the side of the underdog. I just have always been on the side of the underdog. I was undersized myself for a long time until 16 or 17 years of age, quite undersized. But I don't know that that's the explanation for it. I just instinctively like to stand up for the
underdog. So would this have been in school? You'd have sort of stood up for people,
yeah.
And you'd have taken the side of someone who was being bullied or that,
yep,
kind of thing?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, typically. Yeah, not very effectively sometimes, but that's where my sympathies lay. And I sort of happened into criminal defense in part through a chance meeting with the man who's been the best criminal defense lawyer in Wisconsin during my lifetime, and has turned out to be my most enduring and demanding mentor, and then another partner of his and his wife, who was also his law partner. The three of them really made me into a criminal defense lawyer.
So it was really meeting him as a person you looked up to and admired and all that he gave you that sort of changed. Did you talk to him about the fact that you were shy and that you didn't think your personality suited it? What did he have to say about that?
I think he knew it. And he's anything but a shy
personality. What's his name?
Personality.
Just to give him his
credit. Jim Shello.
Okay.
Jim Shello. And his wife Gilda Shello was his partner. And then Steve Glynn, who is a generation down from Jim. Jim is now 91 years old. Gilda passed away in the summer of 2005. But Jim and Steve are still very much present in my life. And I think Jim... Jim's a complicated man, but one of his great virtues is that he values people as they are, and I think is good at helping you find the spark, and then develop. He gave me enormous chances to develop, in part because he's just got such a good way of being overtly, undisguisedly critical and yet having you feel very much like you'll do it better the next time.
Wow, that is such a skill, isn't it? Because
it's
there's a fine line,
skill,
isn't it, between somebody criticizing you and then making you feel like, right, well, that's it, I'll never do it again because I'm useless, and then actually hearing the criticism and wanting to go forward and do things better.
The first time I did something in front of him on my feet in a courtroom, my knees were knocking, I was soaked in sweat when I came out of there. I lost the motion. And Jim said, "That was fine. Let me tell you everything you did wrong, and you'll do it better the next time."
and
it was just like that.
Did he say it with a smile?
He did. He said it just like I I said it, and he has the most remarkable way of saying things that, that sound like they could destroy you, but in fact affirm and motivate you.
Do you remember first catching sight of the file of Stephen Avery and on that case, and do you remember how you felt at that time?
Sure. Yeah, when I took Stephen Avery's case, it was about 6 months after I had left my role as the federal public defender in Wisconsin, which had meant that I was in federal court and federal court only for 5 years. I had gone back into private practice after 5 years of that, and I was quite eager to demonstrate to colleagues that I could still find the state courthouses, you know, that I could still walk and chew gum at the same time in a state case. But like I say, about 6 months after I made that transition back into private practice, Stephen Avery's family called. He had been charged 3-4 months earlier at that point, had settled his civil case, so he had money to retain counsel. He had both my name, Jerry Buting's name, and I'm sure another, you know, a third or fourth name as well. But I think the family called me first. They told me they had Jerry's name. I've always liked and admired Jerry Buting. We had worked together in the past on cases, never in the same firm, but on cases. So I thought this might be a great opportunity to work with Jerry on a case for the first time, representing the same client. And you couldn't live in Wisconsin in the fall of 2005 and early winter 2006 without being aware of Stephen Avery, because of the massive publicity that his travails got. And I knew of him from the 1985 conviction. Indeed, the Shell and Glynn firm had represented him back in the mid-90s in a first effort to try to secure his release on that wrongful conviction. So I had known of him for years, and his case was daily news. And it was one of these things that if you are a real criminal defense lawyer, and I think I was, and am, certainly by 2005, I was a criminal defense lawyer. The most hated person in the world is the one next to whom you want to stand. And so I felt very fortunate when they called me, and even more fortunate that there was enough money to get me and Jerry in and not lose our shirts.
And what about when the filmmakers came to say what they wanted to do? How did you respond to that initially?
Warily, as we should have. We knew that the filmmakers already were there, that they were part of the background, if you will, and that they were trying to make a film. The question whether Jerry and I would participate in that was very much an open question, though, Roshan. Jerry especially thought, well, this will be a good opportunity for the public, if the film ever gets distributed, to see what the defense side does in a case. I was less focused on that, but I knew that my client and his family trusted these filmmakers. We're hoping that shining a light on the case would be a good thing for him. And so Jerry and I decided that we would participate as long as we could secure from the filmmakers an agreement that they would not try to intrude into or breach the lawyer-client privilege, our confidential communications with our client. They promised not to do that, and they kept that promise. The fact that one of the filmmakers, Laura Ricciardi, is a lawyer, gave us some confidence that she understood that, and she did. We also wanted to know that nothing would be shown, nothing would be broadcast or made public until after both Stephen and Brendan's cases were over. And that was a silly thing for us to ask, as it turns out, just because the filmmakers couldn't possibly have, you know, brought anything out publicly in that short amount of time. And indeed, the point of the film was to follow both cases to their conclusion. So that was an easy one for them to assure us that, you know, there would be no film or trailer or short or anything out while the cases still were pending.
So it took a bit of negotiation and a bit of questioning on your part, but then once you were reassured...
Less negotiation than just questions and getting answers from the filmmakers, and they were really quite forthright with us.
Coming out the other side of it, and obviously Stephen Avery is still in prison and that case is going on with Brendan Deasy as well, what do you think has been the value of that Netflix series that has been seen by so many people? What do you feel it has done in terms of changing people's perceptions and informing people, I suppose, about how the legal system works, especially when you are at that lower strata of society?
Well, I hope it's done exactly that. I hope it's fostered a million conversations around the world about, you know, what are the challenges in administering justice? What extra obstacles do the poor face when they're charged? Because almost everybody charged with a crime is poor. What are the pressures under which the police operate? And how might those pressures distort the ways in which the police do their work or testify in court? And what are the pressures that the media produce through pretrial publicity, especially in a culture like the United States, where there's no prior restraint on what the press or the TV or anybody on the internet can say and make public about a pending case? So how do you balance the right to a fair trial for everybody, for the public, for the defendant, for the victim or family?
Let's take that one aspect. I know there's so many issues, but that one aspect, I suppose, here would be very different in that, you know, when a trial is ongoing or pending, you can't, there's so many restrictions on you, and it would be unheard of for that kind of thing to happen and, you know, serious repercussions for any newspaper who did it. But in America, that's not the case. I mean, do you think that's something that should change? And is there any possibility of it changing? Or is it just the way it is there?
I don't think it should change. I do think it presents special problems for administering fair trials in the United States. To my own way of thinking, and I, of course, can't separate this from, you know, from growing up in the U.S. culture, but for my own way of thinking, the public benefits of untrammeled press, unlimited media coverage, on the whole, outweigh the costs to administering justice. And there's all kinds of other costs, too, that, you know, that the unrestricted media discussion we have in the United States carries. I mean, it coarsens the conversation, it divides us, but at the end, as I think we're seeing right now, courageous and fundamentally unrestricted journalists can be the keys to liberty, can be the keys to disseminating public knowledge and allowing us, if we want, the constituent facts to use in more intelligent public debate. And yes, it does create a problem for a fair trial where you've got this onslaught of publicity and opinion about somebody's guilt or innocence, usually guilt. Usually that's the assumption, at least in a culture like the United States, where happily our police by and large operate non-corruptly. They by and large operate with competence. So the public makes an assumption that if you're charged with a crime, you've probably committed the crime in the United States. And of course, it's not always true. And putting the system to the test then becomes harder, where you've had a media frenzy and a good deal of hardening of public opinion around the idea that somebody's guilty. But that's what judges and lawyers are obliged to do. Is to try to sort out people who can't be fair, who've just absorbed too much of the media narrative. And, you know, so between a larger jury pool and more robust questioning of potential jurors and strong, meaningful instructions from judges, those are the tools essentially we have. Mm-hmm. I would not restrict the media. In the end, even though I recognize that administering a fair trial in Ireland is somewhat easier because of the prior restraints on what the media can publish.
I mean, we have a very high-profile rape case going on here at the moment in Belfast, as I'm sure you've been watching. And, you know, you have to be very careful about what they say about that. But you would be of the opinion that the press should be able to have a free-for-all and say whatever they wanted at this point.
I'm not imposing my ideas on what Ireland ought to do or what, you know, what the UK and Northern Ireland ought to do. I'm really not. I recognize I come at this from a cultural perspective. You simply asked me, would I trade a free press for ease in administering fair trials? I wouldn't.
Okay.
It's not that I think fair trials are any less important. It's that I think the work that we have to do to assure a fair trial is worth the gains we get in unrestricted media access and rights to make public.
I mean, it's very interesting to hear you talk about that. And the other aspect, I suppose, the big one is the poverty. I mean, you mentioned it there yourself, and I think I read a quote about something, but if you're in America or probably anywhere, like you say, and you're in a trial or you've been convicted or you've been charged with a crime, you're going to be taken advantage of in some way, that there is just this inevitability almost. So I'm just wondering what you think can be done to make things fairer for people in America and elsewhere as well in that system. Or is it an inevitability?
Well, you can't start in a courtroom. You know, by the time you get to the courtroom, a lifetime of damage has been done by poverty to many of the victims, the accused, no small number of the citizen witnesses, you know, who live in the neighborhoods where they're more likely to witness crime. So you can't begin to start, you know, you can't start in a courtroom. If you want justice, you've got to start with early childhood literacy. You've got to start with adequate housing. You know, you have to level the table, so to speak, much earlier in life. Indeed, that's how you reduce crime, is to reduce its causes and the reasons for it occurring in the first place. By the time you get to a courtroom, the crime has already occurred, the losses occurred for the victim. You know, we've incurred huge social losses by the time something's in court. So justice starts much earlier and, you know, really has to, I think, focus on childhood education and opportunities in childhood.
You mentioned there that doing that is shown to reduce crime. It seems very simple. It seems like an answer, but obviously it takes a lot of resources and all that kind of thing. And it takes an attitude, a mind shift for people too. Do you see that happening? Or is this incarceration and locking up of people such a huge industry and such a way of life in America that, and elsewhere, so I'm not just putting it on America, but is it just so ingrained that this is what happens and that lots of black people, lots of poor people will end up being chucked in prison?
I think that while the issues are common and cut across cultures, that at least in degree and in some ways in quality, it is different in the United States. We lock up many, many more people as a percentage of our population than does any other country. And we lock them up for longer. It's not just a higher rate of incarceration. It's also longer sentences. Now, part of that is the heterogeneity of our population. You're right. We're ethnically and racially diverse, and newcomers and racial or ethnic outsiders always wind up disproportionately represented or overrepresented in the criminal justice system because they're overrepresented among the poor. And you are correct as well that a great deal is invested in kind of an industrial prison complex in the United States. It's not my term. It's a term that's been around for a long time. That said, I do think we are seeing rethinking of that in the United States now. We are seeing incarceration rates begin to drop. We're beginning to see median sentence length edging downward in the United States. So it's not a hopeless project even there. I'd like to see more leadership from the United States in this area, because if, as you do in the United States, we've got 5%, maybe not even 5% of the world's population, but more than 20% of the world's prison population. If you can begin to make change there, it's just a natural example for the rest of the world, because so disproportionately we are the world's prison keeper. Mm-hmm. I'd like to see that sort of change exported, but I'd also like to see the United States open it up itself up to ideas from other countries more than we do. Mm-hmm. We are always our own reference point in the United States, and I think that's a cultural tragedy in the United States, that we are so slow to look for best practices in the Czech Republic or in the Republic of Ireland or in France or Mauritania or, wherever in the world you might find good ideas, because we don't have any monopoly on them in the United States.
I just want to ask you briefly before you go about a couple of things. The Innocence Project is something you're very much involved in. Can you tell us what that is?
Well, the Innocence Project was and is a project in New York that has licensed its name now around the world, often law school-based but sometimes community-based projects. And these, more than Making a Murderer or any other true crime book or movie or podcast, I think have driven public awareness of the error rate in any system of criminal justice. DNA and exonerations of people wrongly convicted by DNA, which have largely been the work of the Innocence Projects, more than any factor, I think, have caused people to think about what kinds of error rates our system of criminal mm-hmm. justice has, what we can do about the specific causes of wrongful conviction.
Okay, and you've been here for a month. I'm just wondering what you've observed about Irish law, and is there anything that, I know you don't want to sort of impose anything on us, but have you observed anything yourself in the time you've been here that you think Ireland should do differently in a legal sense?
I'm not going to venture anything you should do differently. What I will say is that much more feels common than uncommon. It feels familiar than unfamiliar if you plop an American lawyer down in an Irish courthouse. Yes, there are differences, but I'm oriented when I walk in. I know essentially what's happening. And I'm struck here, whether in Limerick City or anywhere else, I'm struck here by how the intake process in the lower level criminal courts look the same whether you're in Hobart, Tasmania, or Limerick City, Ireland, or Chicago, Illinois, in the United States, Stockholm, Sweden, for that matter. The day-to-day traffic in the lower-level criminal cases, especially at the intake level, looks very much the same no matter where you are in the world, I think.
Okay, that's a very diplomatic answer. I'm sure there's other thoughts that you're having that you're keeping from me. Just on the Eighth Amendment, have you been following that constitutional issue? You know, we have a referendum coming up. What is your take on that? Because obviously Roe versus Wade, influenced a lot of things around the world in terms of, access to abortion and stuff.
Well, boy. You throw me the hard ones, don't you? I'm a pro-choice Catholic. Contradiction though that is.
It's not a contradiction. There's many Catholics for choice.
Well, there are many Catholics for choice, and I'm one of them. And how we reconcile that with our personal faith is personal. And but I'll tell you, I wouldn't impose my faith on anyone for anything. And I respect both sides of this argument. There are very, very powerful arguments on both sides of this. And I have to say what I've heard on Irish radio is a more respectful, thoughtful conversation than I usually hear about abortion in the United States, where we've been living with it now for 45 years as sort of an open sore, an open wound in the national psyche. We've not moved past that. I don't know what the path beyond sort of a separating wound on that issue is, but I do know that there are people of good faith on both sides of this issue, and for myself, I wouldn't impose my faith or my own views on a woman carrying a fetus, or on a man, or anybody else for that matter.
So you've been here for a month. Ireland, what's your verdict?
I love Ireland. It's easy to feel at home here if you're from the States, for reasons that I think are obvious. But I have felt welcomed. The Irish have a saying that they use in a different context than we do in the United States, which is they often say to you, "You're very welcome." And what they mean is that please feel at home. We're happy to have you here, and that that has always felt genuine. It has always sounded genuine to my ears, coming from Irish lips.
The true crime thing is so huge. I mean, I have friends who that's all they listen to or want to watch. We have a great podcast at the moment done by an English couple called West Cork. I don't know if you've had a chance to. You should check it out. I think you'd enjoy it. What is it, do you think, about this fascination that has got so huge in the last few years?
Well, I think it rises and falls. There's a cycle to interest in true crime, at least in the United States, and I assume anywhere. I hope that people don't get lost in the details of any one case, but instead keep their focus on tomorrow and what will happen in the future, what will happen at the courthouse nearest them, rather than what's happened in the past at in some distant courthouse. As long as we don't get lost in the gritty details or in the pain of a given case, but keep our focus on what we ought to be doing to try to advance and improve the administration of justice, then I think the true crime genre has its good purposes for that.
I have one more very small question, and it's not a hard one, don't worry, but it might be a bit of an embarrassing one. A lot of talk was about you being a very unlikely sex symbol through this making the murderer thing, and descriptions of you as being like Atticus Finch and a most unlikely person to have, but there was people crushing on you, let's say, on the internet. How did you take that? How did your wife take that?
Well, differently, I think. I'm not on social media, so I get told about that more than I see it. It's so wildly improbable that I don't know what to say about it. I mean, you're sitting across from me. You know how improbable it is. Ridiculous.
Sorry, I shouldn't
even
laugh so much.
Of course you
you're
should.
You're a lovely man.
Of course you should. You should laugh out loud, which is exactly what my wife has done.
And what do you do? Have you had it? Has that been a nice thing at all?
Hmm? Well, it's... you know, it's a bit of a come down, obviously, for any man to have pretty young women looking at him and wishing that he was their father. You know, that's tough on the male ego, right? But I am a man of a certain age, and it could be a lot worse.
It could be. Listen, I really appreciate you coming in. It's been fascinating talking to you, and I know that whatever you do around the world in your work, you're going to be making things better or trying to make things better for people in really vulnerable situations. So I'm really grateful to you for that. And thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
That's all we have time for this week. My thanks to Dean Strang, fascinating man, for coming in to speak to me. Today's podcast was produced by Jennifer Ryan. I'm Roisin Ingle, and I'll talk to you next time.